Hello, and welcome to the Investment Conversation. I'm Joseph Graham, head of the Investment Strategist Group here at Lord Abbett. In today's podcast, we'll ask three Lord Abbett partners, our co-heads of fixed income, Rob Lee and Steve Rocco, and our head of equities, Matt DeSico, to bring us up to speed on the risks and opportunities they see in 2024. This is an excerpt of our 2024 Investment Outlook webinar. Please visit lordabbott.com if you'd like to register to view the full presentation. So let's just get started. Let's dig into it. In terms of 2023, I think it was surprising. A lot of people were surprised at the performance. A lot of negative outlooks going into the year. Then the S&P 500 was up 25%. You had Barclays Aggregate close to 5%, right around 5%. You had high yield, somewhere, depending on which index, around 13%. Very surprising. Rob, what do you think was behind that surprising performance? What was going on economically and then markets' reaction?
Okay, well, if you think back to where we were a year ago, market consensus, this is economists, this is strategists, this is lots of market participants, they thought we were going to have a recession in 2023. And who could blame them? Right. When you think about what happened in 2022, you had the Fed hiking very aggressively, more aggressively than they had in decades, 425 basis points of rate hikes in roughly 9 months. You had the Fed also shrinking its balance sheet and withdrawing liquidity from the system. You had an inverted yield curve, which historically has been a pretty reliable precursor slash predictor of recession. So who could blame people and market participants for thinking a recession was likely or possible? Some of them thought a recession was going to happen in the first half of the year. Some thought in the second half. But what do we get? We didn't get a recession. And if you look at GDP growth in real terms, inflation adjusted terms, talking about 2-2.5%, depending on how we end up, you know, when we get the fourth quarter numbers, that's certainly not a recession. The reason you had positive GDP growth is the labor markets were pretty resilient and strong. The consumer stayed strong. The U.S. consumer is roughly 70% of U.S. GDP. And when the consumer is spending and when they have jobs, it's hard to get a recession. Not impossible, but very hard. Secondly, and this is also important, the housing market stayed strong and resilient. And when the Fed hikes rates so aggressively, what usually happens is the most interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy, of which housing is kind of number one, often falls off a cliff. And activity levels in housing, think existing home sales, for example, and transactions did take a hit. But when you look at home prices, they dip down for a period of time, but not that much, think single digits, and then started rising again. So for all of those reasons, we saw pretty strong economy, solid labor markets, decent consumer spending, a resilient economy, and no recession. On top of that, we actually had inflation coming down from very lofty levels in 2022, but making noticeable, substantial, and I think pretty consistent progress downward. The path of inflation was certainly positive for markets. So when you take a big step back, what did we get? Resilient economy, mm-hmm. house prices pretty strong, consumer spending, and inflation coming down. Well, that sure looks like Goldilocks. Perfect for markets, perfect for asset markets. And you saw the result.
And that makes a lot of sense, especially with that backdrop of not expecting, of such a negative expectation. Now, the other element to that, and I think, Steve, you can probably shine some light on this, was credit and just the performance of corporates. You know, over the course of the year, how did margins stay so strong? And just tell us about the kind of evolution of credit over the year.
Sure. You know, Rob, you know, articulated the story of 23 very well. 100 people in the room this time last year, 95 would say we'd been in a recession and we weren't. And that really was the story of 23. You know, as interest rates rose, there was certainly recessions, but recessions in asset classes. I think back to 21 and venture capital. I think back to 21, 22 in real estate that came back around. And then in 23, commercial real estate, clearly interest rate sensitive, you know, parts of the market. And the consumer didn't have that level of interest rate sensitivity, mainly because they're, you know, financed long. and locked in at low rates in their homes, and everybody was employed, and the labor market's very strong. And because of that, when it relates to credit, I think most people coming in would have said, stay defensive, be up in quality. It turns out, coming off a very weak 2022, which mattered, it very much was a down in quality type of rally. So in high yield, triple Cs outperformed single Bs and double Bs, and in investment grade, triple Bs outperformed single A and above. And I think that was not expected, you know, kind of coming into the year. And, you know, the point of margins, you know, I think same is true, you know, when it comes to interest rate sensitivity on the corporate side, where, you know, a lot of corporates were, you know, financed longer, right? And there was a lot of terming out of maturities post-COVID. So you didn't have that interest rate sensitivity. So you didn't have to worry there as much from a margin perspective. So there's been some margin degradation, but still very, very healthy levels of margin.
Yeah, interesting. How about Matt on the equity side? Certainly a great year for some of the mega caps and others. How about the rest of the equity market? What caused it to rally so strongly?
First and foremost, inflation coming in and moderating at better than expected, and doing so without really any sort of economic slowdown. And the translation of economic activity to markets is earnings, corporate earnings. If you remember at the beginning of the year, a lot of people expected that S&P earnings, which were estimated to be about $225 per share, there were suggestions that those numbers were too high. Many people thought that the number would come in closer to $200 per share. You had a few very outspoken bears suggesting the number would be more like $180 per share. We haven't gotten Q4 earnings yet, but it looks like earnings for 2023 are going to come in right around $225 per share. So you had earnings resilience. So that would be the earnings resilience without with inflation coming down, I think, would be the first two meaningful surprises compared to consensus at the beginning of the year. The third you mentioned is the strength of mega cap tech. In the second half of 2022, mega cap tech, or the Magnificent Seven, you know, a lot of those companies were seeing their earnings being revised down. As the calendar turned, their revenues proved to be much more resilient. Those companies also went on efforts to become much more efficient and saw meaningful margin expansion, which led to earnings coming in better than expected. In some cases, meaningfully better than expected. And I think that was really driven by, or a big aspect of that was the thematic impact of generative AI, generative artificial intelligence. ChatGPT launched, exploded onto the scene in late 2022. We were bullish on the impact of generative artificial intelligence. But even I was surprised by how quickly companies translated that into meaningful revenue and earnings upside in both 2023, and it looks like into 2024. The Magnificent Seven in particular perform well, but you're now starting to see that impact spread beyond the Magnificent Seven, and I think it'll be a driver of earnings and revenue growth in 2024 as well.
Interesting. Okay. So a bunch of themes we talked about here. One was that with inflation, companies held margin. Now, as you see inflation kind of backing off, I guess one big question is, can they continue to hold margin? Now, what's your expectation on that is for next year?
I do. I think I think margins for 2024 for equities will continue to improve. I think the large mega cap tech companies were the first to show that level of margin improvement. I think the story of 2024 will be that margin strength can broaden out. But it's more than just margin strength. I think there's also going to be some nice revenue growth from mm-hmm. companies beyond the Magnificent Seven. So I'll pause there. But I'd expect that the margin expansion that we saw in the large companies, you'll see that both in mid-cap stocks as well as small-cap stocks.
How about on the credit side? Do you see coverage ratios, I know, have weakened a bit. How do you see that develop?
Similar story, right? Yeah. I mean, I think through the worst of goods inflation, supply chains have healed, commodity prices have come down. That should all kind of help margin. I think, you know, when we talk about coverage ratios, we are, and we'll get to this, we are in a, you know, higher base rate environment, which is my expectation that will continue to some extent. which means that as you know, kind of you kind of roll through, you refinance and your interest coverage kind of deteriorates. Assuming you don't get, you know, any earnings growth, my expectation is you will get more EBITDA growth. So the coverage ratio should remain relatively stable, if not improve a little bit.
I see.
If your outlook comes to pass.
Okay. Rob, how about rates? Always a tricky one, I know. But what's your view on rates next year? Or okay. This year, now that we're here?
Yeah, in 2024. Yeah. So the calendar year of 2023, I'll use the 10-year treasury yield as a good, you know, example. Ended 2022, started 2023 at around 3.9%. It actually ended 2023 at right around 3.9%, or almost exactly. So if you weren't paying attention and to the markets, you would think nothing happened. But that, as you probably know, masked a lot of volatility during the year. Think back to what happened last March with the regional bank crisis, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and First Republic and others. The 10-year treasury went to about 3.3% as a low in the spring of 2023. Then over the course of 6 or 7 months, peaking in October, a pretty steady rise. The economy was strong, third quarter GDP printed at a very high level, economic activity was strong. As I mentioned before, the labor markets were solid and stable and resilient. And you got to about 5% in October on the 10-year treasury. And then, as you know, in the fourth quarter, we went back down, as I mentioned earlier, to 3.9%. So actually a lot of intra-year volatility, the ebbs and flows of the economic data, inflation coming down, offset in some ways by, you know, resilient economy and strong labor market. What's the outlook for 2024 is your question, and that is a key one. What I would say is the way I think about it, the framework that I use, is point to three main things. The first is, how strong is growth going to be? And I'm talking about both nominal and real GDP growth. I think the projections are about right, and we can talk about why. Maybe some deceleration from 2023, but probably somewhere in the ballpark of 2% real GDP growth. Mm-hmm. The second major pillar of that framework is, what's inflation going to do? We talked about what's happened. We peaked in 2022, depending on the measure you use, at somewhere between 7 and 9%. We're down to 3 or 4%, again, depending on whether you're using CPI or the PCE or the headline or the core. The main question is, are we going to keep going in that direction from 3 or 4 to 2 to 3? The Fed's target is 2%. And I think there's a decent chance of that. The question is, how fast does it happen? So first pillar is economic activity and growth. The second is inflation, the trajectory of inflation, and I think there will be continued progress at some decent rate. And then finally, the Fed reaction function, Fed actions, think rate cuts, which are priced into the market already. And here I think it's possible, at least sitting here, you know, early 2024, that the market's a bit ahead of itself. And what I mean by that specifically is roughly 6 cuts, 25 basis point rate cuts are priced into markets right now. The Fed's pushback against that aggressive Fed cutting cycle, and I think the market may be a little bit ahead of itself. So when I take the big step back, we're not 5% like we were in October of last year. We're closer to 4% on the 10-year treasury. So what I would say is 4% is much higher yield, obviously, than the lows we reached during the COVID crisis. Much more fairly priced. When you really put it together, if you have 2% growth and 2% inflation and a 4% 10-year, it could go up or down, obviously, depending on the evolution of the economy and Fed action. But I think we're much closer to fairly priced now.
Okay.
So can I add on to that? Sure. So there's a lot here. I think one of the things that contributed to the rally that we saw late last year was the Fed introducing the idea of kind of rate cuts outside of recession, which is extremely bullish. And I do believe the Fed is restrictive now, and they know that. So as hopefully if inflation continues to come down, they become more restrictive, they're going to fine tune.
The problem, as Rob suggests, is the market kind of extrapolated. Now you're pricing in kind of six cuts. To me, to get to that, it's probably a much more severe economic scenario than is my base case or probably Rob's base case as well. And then the other thing you introduce is financial conditions, right? And so financial conditions loosen, and that kind of may swing you back, right, the other way. And some of this also, since we're talking a lot about the U.S., some of this is also predicated, you know, internationally too, on international growth, right? China was a big disappointment, as well as Europe last year. Does China stimulate more? Does manufacturing recover? Right, smaller part of the economy, but I think relevant for next year's outlook. And then does that introduce either, you know, higher kind of growth expectation and bring the Fed back in and take out some of these cuts? Not necessarily a negative kind of argument for some of the areas that we invest in, because you'd still be in a relatively high nominal growth environment, which should benefit credit. That's a good thing. But it may change the overall kind of composition of how you think about your portfolios and kind of what factors may work in that environment.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We actually recently put out a paper on this, that high nominal growth and the inflation that can come along with that is actually good for credit. I think sometimes people think that it eats into credit, which it can, but if you keep up with it, you actually need credit more in a portfolio because your real value of that dollar is starting to weaken.
One of the biggest things was underestimated last year, especially as it relates to high yield. That high yield investor wants you would want high nominal.
Yeah,
it's great for down in quality exposure.
How about equities? How do equities survive, Matt, in a inflation environment that is higher than it has been historically, but coming down? How do equities typically do?
Well, I think I generally agree with Rob's assessment, and I think a 2% real GDP world and a 2 to 3% inflation, 4 or 5% nominal. Corporate earnings generally grow faster than nominal GDP, so maybe 7 to 9% corporate earnings. With the Fed out of the picture after, you know, 2 years of extreme tightening, I think it's a very good backdrop for equities, because you can get that, you know, 7 to 10% earnings growth without the risk of significant multiple compression from the Fed. So I would view that that outcome as a very favorable one for the equity markets.
Okay. How about, Rob, you mentioned 4% as a 10-year, kind of a reasonable range to be in. How about the short end and maybe just a view of relative value along the curve?
Right. Okay. So as I suggested earlier, or mentioned earlier, the yield curve is still inverted. So the 2-year treasury yield is above the 10-year treasury yield and above the 30-year treasury yield. It is not as inverted as it got earlier in 2023, where it was at one of its most inverted points in a long time.
Over 100 basis points inverted.
Over 100 basis points. Lots of different yield curve slopes if you use the 2-year to the 30-year. Mm-hmm. Some people use 2-year to 10-year. Some people use Fed funds to 10-year. But it was very, very inverted, right? The reason people would hide out in cash or buy T-bills, and sometimes that makes sense, was because of that yield differential. It was just you're paid to wait, if you will. What we saw, quite frankly, later in 2023 was you can leave a lot on the table in terms of price appreciation because we went from 5% to 4% on the 10-year treasury. And we turned, I'll use the Bloomberg Aggregate Index, bond index, we were negative 3 or 4% in total return at, you know, year to date at one point. And very quickly, you know, you got 8 to 10% returns. Again, it's hard to time those things perfectly, but the curve is much less inverted than it used to be. But yields are still reasonably attractive. If the Fed does cut aggressively, which is, I think a lot is priced in already, but if it does cut aggressively, you get what we call, bond people call a bull steepener, meaning the 2-year treasury yield comes down and prices go up. The 10-year treasury yield goes down, not as much,
right. And
you kind of get back to quote unquote a normal yield curve environment, which means positively slope, where longer maturities yield have higher yields than shorter maturities. 2024 will be an interesting year, we'll find out.
As a reminder, listeners can get more insights on the market and economy in the coming year by registering to view our 2024 Investment Outlook presentation at lordabbott.com. Now back to our discussion. One thing you mentioned, Steve, was the consumer sort of reacted a little differently this time. When rates went up, they didn't necessarily have a lot of floating rate debt. Rob, you mentioned a lot of 30-year mortgages, so a lot of fixed debt. And I think that was one of the differences, where the consumer just didn't care whether rates rose that much. In certain sectors, yes. Are you still seeing that? Is the consumer starting to turn over now? I know we've seen a rise in delinquencies. What's your expectation for next year for consumer?
Okay, so I'll start and say, structurally underestimating the US consumer as a blanket statement is a risky thing to do. Especially if people have jobs. If the labor market is stable, reasonably healthy, although I think it is normalized, it's decelerated some, but a year ago it was running pretty hot, and 2 years ago it was running pretty hot. So I call this, you can call it deceleration, that's true. I would call it normalization. When people have jobs and real wages, by the way, we talked about inflation coming down last year, especially in the second half, real wages, inflation-adjusted wages, started to turn positive. So when people have jobs and they have real wage growth, consumer spending is pretty decent. That being said, the normalization, the deceleration, I think is fair. The fiscal stimulus that we got in 2020 in response to COVID and 2021, additional fiscal stimulus, definitely helped the US consumer. You can see it in deposit levels at banks. You can see it in everyone would talk about excess savings. There is some element of that gets spent over time, but I'll go back to my main point, which is you have a job and you have real wage growth. And on top of that, prices at the pump, energy prices are lower. Natural gas prices are lower. We're going into the winter. So I think maybe some normalization, deceleration, but not falling off a cliff, not a collapse is my view.
I see.
So again, this is a big subject, but I'd say there's a couple things here. And first I apply it to like the US economy, right? Economies don't just roll over, right? There needs to be some sort of shock. One of them could be an oil price shock. Now, if you remember in Q3, there was very much worry coming up, Q3 heading into Q4, the consumer was gonna roll over because oil prices were gonna spike and excess savings was winding down. Rob was talking about some of those things. Since then, we've seen revisions to actually what that excess saving number actually is, which shows that it was probably higher than people thought. I'm not saying there are not parts of the consumer that aren't weakening, there actually are. But then at the same time, we actually got lower oil prices, which matter. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of job openings, right? It's coming down off, I think March was the peak at 12.5 million in job openings. Now you're down to 8. That's good. So the market is loosening somewhat. But it's still a very, very healthy labor market. And as long as that remains the case, I don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just echo something Rob said earlier, which is the importance of, and I look at them too, weekly jobless claims to assess what Steve is talking about, if there is some sort of shock and what the impact would be on the consumer. If you saw a 40 or 50% rise in weekly jobless claims, a moving average, so from the low 200s up into the high 200,000s, close to 300,000, then I think you do have to worry about economic growth, and you have to worry about the consumer, and then you have to worry about US economic growth, you have to worry about S&P earnings, you have to worry broadly about corporate earnings, you have to worry about markets. So that indicator to me is one that's critical to watch to see if the economy is in fact weakening. And we've been watching it for the last 2 years. And like Rob said, it's remarkably consistent.
Yeah.
Just to jump in here, so tying some of the themes together, one of the things that can cause layoffs and cutting of labor and thus, a potential recession is if companies, both large, medium, and small, their margins start to get squeezed too much. And then to preserve revenue and income and cash flow, they cut one of the main areas, one of the main expenses, which are people. And that's why it's so important to watch margins. And if they stay pretty healthy, whether you're talking about gross margins or operating margins or EBITDA margins, they stay pretty healthy and we watch pretty carefully. It's not impossible, but pretty unlikely that you're going to get large job cuts.
Okay. Yeah. And just tying it back to what I was talking about with the large technology companies, and actually a number of technology companies, is they hired a lot in 21 and 22. They then had to dial that back. And what was surprising was as they dialed that back, their growth rates really were only minimally impacted. Now we'll see if in 24 and 25 that those growth rates are then impacted. But you, again, Goldilocks is a bit of a theme here. A lot of these technology companies were able to reduce somewhat their labor force, but not see it impact growth and still see a dramatic improvement in margins. Now, technology companies don't employ nearly as many people as other retail or manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So while those headlines were coming out, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is so bad for the economy. But when you actually, the numbers ended up not being in aggregate that meaningful across the overall economy, because you didn't see that outside of, you did see it outside of technology, but not to the same degree, yeah. Not to the same degree that you saw within technology. Yeah.
One last worry that I hear from a lot of people, and that is the election. Should that be something we're concerned about this year as investors?
From an equity standpoint, it will create volatility. If you look back through the history of market cycles with elections, typically the third year of an election cycle is your best year for returns. The fourth year is not bad, though. Typically, your worst year is the midterm, the second year of an election cycle. So there's fairly good precedence that markets do well during presidential elections. But I will say this, though, that in a typical year, it's normal to see a 10% drawdown. And in some cases, it's normal to see at least two of those. I wouldn't be surprised if the election causes volatility, but historically, a presidential election is not any reason to be concerned about equity markets. Yeah. I know this election cycle could be different, mm-hmm. but every election cycle is different.
Yeah, this is what I'd add. So one of the things that gives me some comfort for this particular year, in this presidential and congressional election year, is everybody's talking about it as one of their main risks. People are already worried about it, and it's early in the year. Mm-hmm. So 10 or 11 months is an eternity, as they say, in politics and elections. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second gets at, I'd say, really the structural and foundational strength of the United States. I alluded to some of it before. You have a productive workforce. We have better demographics than many other large developed nations. We have resilient institutions. I'm not making light of kind of polarization. I'm not making light of, you know, less trust in many of the institutions, governing institutions at the federal level. But I'd say their fundamental strength and the foundational level for the country. That's currency, that's developed capital markets, that's rule of law, that's property rights, that's the intellectual capital. And I think that's why generally any election, even though it can create volatility, and those can create opportunities for professional investors like us.
Okay. All right, let's dig into asset classes a little bit and what your areas of opportunity are and possibly areas of risk. Steve, you want to start with credit? What areas do you like this year?
Sure. So I'll say a couple things here. Recognizing that we had a pretty large rally in spreads to end to Q4, which may have taken away some of the return that one would expect this year. Because if you look at overall spread levels, let's take kind of large sectors like investment grade at 100 basis points or U.S. high yield at, let's say, 325 to 350. That's kind of a top decile environment for tight spread. However, you still have a lot of yield. And I think yield and carry still matter here. And that's how we're trying to optimize our portfolios. And I think you may not want to take on too much kind of tail risk, default risk, because you're in a higher base rate environment, and there may be pressures that can kind of play through in certain parts of the market. So we're trying to avoid those things. But overall, I think you want to earn carry, and you can get very good carry in U.S. high yield. You can get, you know, you can get decent carry in the front end of investment grade as well, in U.S. investment grade, and even parts of securitized product as well. And so that's kind of how we're looking to optimize our portfolios.
So you mentioned companies may have trouble refinancing in higher rate environments. Does that mean you expect default rates to tick up this year, or do you think it'll be relatively
flat? I actually think they're going to drop.
Okay.
And I think the market is priced for what we expect. Now, thinking about where default rates are right now, there's two numbers. One is kind of, you know, just defaults, which is like 3%, give or take, in U.S. high yield and a little bit higher in leveraged loans. Then there's defaults, including distressed exchanges, which gets you to about 4%. There's actually been a lot of distressed exchanges. But my expectation is those numbers will drop, and the U.S. default rate will move closer to 2.5% in high yield, stay a little bit elevated in leveraged loans because the base rate effect is more prevalent there. And when you add that all up, and the amount of excess spread that one should expect from high yield, X your kind of, you know, kind of your default expectation and your recovery rates, which is an important concept, because what we've seen is recovery rates have dropped, in particular on the loan side. And we have a lot more loan-only structures, which means there's not a lot of cushion below you. And that's bled into high yield somewhat, because you have a lot more kind of secured issuance in high yield, and then that unsecured piece is being layered. So your recovery rates have moved lower. But even with those kind of elements at play, I think you're kind of in a fair value spread level based on our kind of default forecast. And then what becomes very interesting in high yield is kind of the triple Cs. So usually you see a couple of good years in a row of triple C performance. You had a very bad 2022 to a very strong 2023. We think there's more kind of elements at play to suggest that some of that triple C spread can normalize closer to, let's say, a pre-COVID environment. So we're looking a little bit more kind of down the capital structure there to see if there are opportunities while trying to avoid some of the, you know, some of that tail risk that we talked about.
I see. That tightening you mentioned also relevant for IG, a great fourth quarter for IG. Do you expect that strength to continue? And what kind of areas are you looking at, Rob?
Okay, so this is what I'd say, and it'll rhyme a lot with what Steve said. Spreads tighten. It was a bull market in 2023 after a bad bear market in 2022 in almost every asset class. You had spread tighten in most sectors, spread sectors of fixed income, you know, non-treasuries, things with a yield that is higher than treasuries at any given maturity point. Did that steal from 2024 returns and carry? Maybe some. When you look at the long-term averages and current trading levels, we are definitely tighter than the long-term. By long-term, I mean 20 plus years of history. We are definitely tighter, but I think that reflects the Fed, quote unquote, pivot. Pretty solid fundamentals, as we described earlier. And therefore, one needs to be selective. And when I say selective, there are areas of the market that we like. One doesn't need to be a hero to get some pretty attractive assets. I'll give you an example or two. Talk about short asset-backed securities tied to the consumer balance sheet and ability to repay. Talk about some of the largest and best-known companies, investment-grade corporate issuers in the fixed income space. You can still get 5% yields for short maturity, not a lot of volatility, those instruments. And that is pretty good. Remember back to the days, as I said, of COVID in, I think, August of 2020, the two-year treasury was yielding 0.1%, and the 10-year treasury was yielding 0.5%. I think the 30-year was just above 1%. I'm picking below, but we're a far cry from that. So you get that pretty decent treasury yield, and you get some, I wouldn't say incredibly all-time attractive spread levels beyond that, but you can still get 5% yields at the short end of the curve for very solid, very fundamentally sound liquid instruments. I'll talk about one other that we are looking at in the high-quality fixed income space, and that's AAA commercial mortgage-backed securities. It has been a very difficult environment with such aggressive Fed rate hikes, plus the regional bank crisis. Regional banks lend to a lot of real estate borrowers. And that's been a difficult environment. On top of that, you had COVID and the debates and the issues with return to office and office usage, a big segment and property type within commercial mortgage-backed securities. Well, you might look at me and say, hey, you're crazy, you're looking at CMBS. And as investors, that's often a good place to look. You want the timing right, you want the level right, and you want, very importantly, very strong security selection and fundamental research. But after such a crisis and so many headwinds, that's often the best place to find great value. And the newer vintages, the stuff that's been issued since the COVID crisis and the Fed hikes, well, that is pretty cleaned up, well scrubbed, much more conservatively underwritten and scrutinized by investors. And the spreads are still pretty attractive.
I mean, usually when people tell you you're crazy or it's hard to buy, those are usually the best things to buy. And I agree with you on the 24 vintage of CRE up in quality. The other thing I'd say, just kind of add on to this, if you go back to last year, I called it the year of panic, right? Because then that's kind of these frequent narrative shifts that you can get caught up in as an investor, right? That goes like the regional banking crisis, hard landing, then it's soft landing, it's no landing, it's reacceleration, then it's Goldilocks. And I think trading those extremes, I think if you do it, you know, countercyclically, right, it actually was a good thing for you. But if you get caught up in any one of them, it becomes a very bad thing. And so we want to keep kind of the big picture, you know, front and center. And if you believe in this idea that the economic environment's going to hold, then it's, you're going to earn your carry.
How about equities, Matt? What areas do you like?
Yeah, so start with some themes, because I think there's themes that cut across a number of different different types of equities that are attractive. We talked about, or I mentioned generative artificial intelligence before. I think that will continue to be a theme, not just in 2024, but beyond 2024. I think this technology is the seminal technology of this decade, like the integrated circuit of the 70s, like the personal computer of the 80s. Like the internet of the 90s, like the iPhone of the 2010s, the iPhone of the 2000s, cloud of the 2010s. So I think this is going to have an impact for the next several years. And so generative artificial intelligence, there's a number of different ways to play that beyond just technology stocks. So that's a big theme for 2024. I think the uptick in industrial spend due to the reorganization of manufacturing after COVID, due to fiscal spending, due to geopolitics. I think there's companies that benefit from that. Again, that cut across a number of different sectors that are very attractive. I think medical innovations, last year, a big story was new innovations in metabolic diseases. I think medical innovations is going to be a big theme in 2024 in metabolic diseases and neurological diseases, as well as in rare diseases. Other more mature trends, but still have a lot of runway left, is the conversion to cloud computing, as well as the conversion from offline to online spending, whether it be for goods, whether it be for services, for streaming, for advertising. So those are themes that really cut across a number of different areas. I think if you think about what types of stocks can do well in 24, I think growth stocks, based upon a 2% kind of real GDP environment, growth stocks tend to do well in that backdrop, just because the scarcity of growth makes companies that can grow secularly 10, 15, 20% more attractive. They're more scarce. I also would highlight that some of those themes I mentioned tend to cut across all sectors, but they hit a lot of the growth sectors. I think quality stocks, I know that's an evergreen recommendation, and I do think quality stocks should be part of any good portfolio. But particularly in a normalized interest rate environment, companies with high return on equity, with low debt to capital, with good management teams that can allocate capital efficiently, are particularly attractive. The third area is we have to look at small cap stocks, just because after a lackluster 23 for small cap earnings, certainly compared to what I described for large cap earnings, it looks like small cap earnings are set to rebound in 2024. And more importantly, you're getting prices that we haven't seen in small cap stocks, at least relative to large cap stocks, in 25 years. And I do feel good that that the earnings growth this year will be better than it was last year. Growth stocks, quality stocks, small cap stocks, and those five themes would be areas I'd look to invest.
So we'll wrap things up here. Once again, you can view a video of the full presentation by registering at lordabbott.com. On the podcast page, you can download a deck containing slides that provide additional color on the topics discussed here. And please be sure to check out our 2024 investment outlook on lordabbott.com to view our full suite of commentaries covering a broad range of asset classes. And lastly, we'd also like to hear from our listeners. So if you have any comments about today's podcast or ideas for future podcasts, we welcome your thoughts. Please email us at podcast@lordabbott.com. This has been the Investment Conversation Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Asset allocation or diversification does not guarantee a profit or protect against loss in declining markets. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. The value of investments and any income from them is not guaranteed and may fall as well as rise, and an investor may not get back the amount originally invested. Investment decisions should always be made based on an investor's specific financial needs, objectives, goals, time horizon, and risk tolerance. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. Equity investing risks. The value of investments in equity securities will fluctuate in response to general economic conditions and to changes in the prospects of particular companies and/or sectors in the economy. While growth stocks are subject to the daily ups and downs of the stock market, their long-term potential as well as their volatility can be substantial. Value investing involves the risk that the market may not recognize that securities are undervalued and they may not appreciate as anticipated. Smaller companies tend to be more volatile and less liquid than larger companies. Small cap companies may also have more limited product lines, markets, or financial resources and typically experience a higher risk of failure than large cap companies. Fixed income investing risks. The value of investments in fixed income securities will change as interest rates fluctuate and in response to market movements. Generally, when interest rates rise, the prices of debt securities fall, and when interest rates fall, prices generally rise. High-yield securities, sometimes called junk bonds, carry increased risks of price volatility, illiquidity, and the possibility of default in the timely payment of interest and principal. Bonds may also be subject to other types of risk, such as call, credit, liquidity, and general market risks. Longer-term debt securities are usually more sensitive to interest rate changes. The longer the maturity of a security, the greater the effect a change in interest rates is likely to have on its price. The credit quality of fixed income securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, NRSARO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, highest, to D, lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, junk bonds. High-yielding, non-investment-grade bonds, junk bonds, involve higher risks than investment-grade bonds. Adverse conditions may affect the issuer's ability to pay interest and principal on these securities. A basis point is 1/100th of a percentage point. Bear Stepener describes the widening of the yield curve caused by long-term interest rates increasing at a faster rate than short-term rates. A bull steepener is when the curve widens because short-term yields have fallen more than long-term yields. Carry is the difference between the yield on a longer maturity bond and the cost of borrowing. Coverage ratio measures a company's cash flow available to pay current debt obligations. Duration is a measure of the sensitivity of the price, the value of principal, of a fixed income investment to a change in interest rates. EBITDA refers to a company's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. The Federal Reserve, Fed, is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, Fed funds, rate is the target interest rate set by the Fed at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight. The federal funds rate is the interest rate at which depository institutions lend reserve balances to other depository institutions overnight on an uncollateralized basis. The Fed's reaction function refers to how the U.S. central bank modifies monetary policy in response to economic developments. GDP refers to gross domestic product. Those with a hawkish view of monetary policy are focused on inflation. They favor raising interest rates to restrict the supply of money. Dovish monetary policy supports economic growth and aims to achieve maximum employment. It seeks to lower interest rates or keep them low because loose monetary policy increases the money supply. A Goldilocks environment is one in which an economy has steady growth, preventing a recession, but not so much growth that inflation rises by too much. The Magnificent Seven is a popular term encompassing megacap stocks Apple Incorporated, Amazon, Com Incorporated, Alphabet Incorporated, Meta Platforms Incorporated, Microsoft Corporation, Nvidia Corporation, and Tesla Incorporated. The U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, is a measure that examines the weighted average of prices of a basket of consumer goods and services, such as transportation, food, and medical care. It is calculated by taking price changes for each item in the predetermined basket of goods and averaging them.
The U.S. Producer Price Index, PPI, is a family of indexes that measures the average change over time in selling prices received by domestic producers of goods and services. The U.S. Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, PCE, also referred to as the PCE deflator, is a United States-wide indicator of the average increase in prices for all domestic personal consumption. It is benchmarked to a base of 2009 is equal to 100. Using a variety of data, including U.S. Consumer Price Index and Producer Price Index prices, it is derived from personal consumption expenditures. The largest component of U.S. gross domestic product in the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, National Income and Product Accounts report. Spread is the percentage difference in current yields of various classes of fixed income securities versus treasury bonds or another benchmark bond measure. Vintage refers to a mortgage-backed security that is seasoned over some time period. Yield is the income returned on an investment, such as the interest received from holding a security. The yield is usually expressed as an annual percentage rate based on the investment's cost, current market value, or face value. Yield to maturity, YTM, represents the expected return, expressed as an annualized rate, from the bond's future cash flows, including coupon payments over the life of the bond and the bond's principal value received at maturity. Yield to worst refers to the lesser of a bond's A, yield to maturity, or B, the lowest yield to call calculated on each scheduled call date. Yield curve is a line that plots the interest rates at a set point in time of bonds having equal credit quality but differing maturity dates. One such comparison involves the 2-year and 10-year U.S. Treasury debt. This yield curve is used as a benchmark for other debt in the market, such as mortgage rates or bank lending rates. The curve is also used to predict changes in economic output and growth. References to interest rate moves are based on Bloomberg data. The Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index represents securities that are SEC registered, taxable, and dollar denominated. The index covers the U.S. investment grade, fixed rate bond market, with index components for government and corporate securities, mortgage pass-through securities, and asset-backed securities. Total return comprises price appreciation slash depreciation and income as a percentage of the original investment. Bloomberg Index Information. Source, Bloomberg Index Services Limited. Bloomberg is a trademark and service mark of Bloomberg Finance L.P. and its affiliates, collectively Bloomberg. Bloomberg owns all proprietary rights in the Bloomberg indices. Bloomberg does not approve or endorse this material or guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information herein, or make any warranty, express or implied, as to the results to be obtained therefrom and, to the maximum extent allowed by law, shall not have any liability or responsibility for injury or damages arising in connection therewith. The S&P 500 Index is widely regarded as the standard for measuring large-cap U.S. stock market performance and includes a representative sample of leading companies in leading industries. Indexes are unmanaged, do not reflect the deduction of fees or expenses, and are not available for direct investment. The credit quality of fixed income securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, NRSARO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, highest, to D, lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, junk bonds. Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to, securities of those companies. Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and are subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. Certain information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources and such information has not been independently verified by Lord Abbott. No representation, warranty, or undertaking expressed or implied is given to the accuracy or completeness of such information by Lord Abbott or any other person. While such sources are believed to be reliable, Lord Abbott does not assume any responsibility for the accuracy or completeness of such information. Lord Abbott does not undertake any obligation to update the information contained herein as of any future date. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speakers are those of the speakers as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. This broadcast is the copyright 2024 of Lord Abbott and Company, LLC, all rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC. Additional information on this podcast, along with an edited transcript, may be obtained by visiting lordabbott.com.